to America's Web Radio, and now it's time for the infectious disease program. On the phone, we've got Sharon Sanders from Flu Trackers, as always, on my dad, and we're glad to have her. And she has a very, very special guest from the World Health Organization. Sharon, you want to introduce your guest, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, as usual. We're very pleased and happy to announce that Mr. Gregory Hartle is with us today to discuss primarily pandemic influenza, but also, you know, what the WHO does and the status of general status of disease in the world. He is the project leader and information management and communications person for the World Health Organization. Particularly, he works with the Department of Epidemic and Pandemic Alert and Response. Welcome, Mr. Hartle.
Hello, thank you.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do at the WHO?
Well, the title is so exhaustive, it already says quite a bit. But so I run communications for the department at WHO, which it used to do all epidemic and pandemic diseases. We most recently are splitting off the influenza response from other epidemic diseases because the influenza with the pandemic we've just declared has become so, let's say, large that it needs a specialized department. But I still run the communications for the H1N1 response, too.
Great. Why don't you tell everyone exactly what WHO does? Many of our listeners and our people who log onto our site are students throughout the world. If you could just tell us what the World Health Organization is, what your mandate is, that would be great.
Sure. So WHO is a specialized organization within the United Nations family. And as the name says, we deal in health. So we are mandated to try to improve health systems in the world's developing countries. We have our headquarters in Geneva. We have 6 regional offices located around the world, and then we have country offices in almost 150 countries, so in the world's developing countries, where we work can work very directly with national ministries of health to help them improve the health services that they can give their people.
Great. Where does the money for WHO come from? Do you get the direct stipends from the UN or also extra money? Where does the money from?
Well, the vast, vast majority of the money comes from governments. So it doesn't come from each organization within the United Nations system has its own budget, and the budget is decided by the governments, which are member states of WHO, and they pay us what's called an annual regular budget, and then they can decide also to give additional monies for specific projects.
Okay, that sounds great. So what about something like the Gates Foundation? If they want, I know they're particularly interested in HIV in Africa. Do they run in parallel with you or kind of thing? Do they donate money to you directly? For instance, I'm using them as an example. If you had a major nonprofit organization, or they do their own thing?
Yeah, there are foundations like the Gates Foundation, which will donate money sometimes to us and sometimes do things directly. And the money that they donate to us, the Gates Foundation is its main strategy, as I understand it, is for technological solutions in support of health. And those can be mostly, let's say, for us, it would be to support vaccine technology and other technologies. So, yes, we do get support from the Gates Foundation.
Great. I guess we should jump right in it, of course. The World Health Organization declared a 6th pandemic in reference to the novel H1N1 swine. And then I guess we'll go and talk about the level 3 pandemic that we have with bird flu or avian influenza. Basically, you know, what's the status of novel H1N1 flu now?
Yeah, so as you said, on the 11th of June, we declared, or we moved to phase 6, which means that we are now in the first pandemic of the 21st century. As of yesterday, the case count was over 52,000, and so those are cases around the world which have been confirmed in a laboratory and then reported to WHO. So there should be probably many more cases because surveillance systems aren't designed to and aren't expected to pick up all cases. And especially with this virus, there's probably a lot of mild cases out there. And after a certain point, countries, for example, Canada and the United States, have openly said that they are not counting any longer all individual cases because it doesn't make sense from a public health resources point of view.
Correct. I think basically you can't possibly count all influenza-like illnesses. You have to, I guess, count them as best you can, and then there's some guesstimating or extrapolating that goes on.
Yes, exactly. That's right. So it's, as you say, you first of all, we assume that there's probably a lot of mild cases that haven't been detected, and after a certain point, because flu tends to transmit so widely, it's not practical any longer after a certain point to try to count all cases. So, as you say, there's a guesstimates that then occur.
Right. So the numbers that we're getting, I guess, from actually many countries where it's becoming a larger spread, then is reflected in the WHO numbers. Basically, the WHO numbers are just what the various countries have reported to you, and so if those numbers would be low, then that's, you don't have teams in every country monitoring every case of H1N1 independently of what those member countries are already doing.
No. We are a member organization, so we work through our member states, our board of governors, who are national ministries of health. So they report to us, and then we relay that information to the world as a whole. The advantage or the benefit that we bring is that we can provide a global perspective so that people can see what's happening outside their own country and that how their own country fits into the larger picture when there is a larger picture.
And so basically the numbers we're looking at now, pretty much, at least for sure in North America, and probably as we spread around the world, is we're looking more at, maybe you might say, a trend analysis type of numbers as opposed to actual case numbers of actual cases that we can't, it's impossible to count anymore.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I'm not sure what special meaning a trend analysis might have, but certainly, I mean, what we're seeing, the most important thing to take away from this is that from the numbers that I mentioned, 52,000, is more the fact that the numbers are growing in almost all countries that have reported cases, and there are an increasing number of countries reporting cases. So we are seeing a legitimate global spread of this virus. We aren't yet seeing sustained community transmission in many countries, but that probably will come.
Sure. At the beginning of this, I feel like this has been going on for a really long time, but actually it hasn't. But let's say a month ago, when we were much earlier in the pandemic or epidemic at that point, so a lot of countries were saying, oh, well, we're going to stop this swine flu thing from coming in and we're not going to get it. But clearly, with the characteristics of what influenza is, it's practically impossible to do that, no?
That's also why influenza has always been considered probably the disease most likely to cause a pandemic. Most other diseases tend to not spread beyond more locally confined regions and consequently only cause epidemics. But because influenza does spread so easily, yes, it's very, very difficult to stop it once it starts, especially when the virus is efficient in transmitting through several generations from person to person. You mentioned earlier H5N1, and what's happened so far with H5N1, because we know that H5N1 has killed 60% of the people it's infected, is that it doesn't transmit easily from person to person, whereas this H1N1 does seem to do so.
Correct. And I think by the time we had discovered it was out there, it was already in the communities.
Sure. It was the first case is probably took place a number of months before it got onto anyone's radar screen, and that's probably quite usual for an influenza virus where the majority of influenza symptoms are mild, you know, or self-limiting. If, as was the case with H5N1, all of a sudden you had started out with, cases in the community where 90% of the cases had died, then of course it would have been noticed much faster.
Could you give us? We've discussed the definition of a level six, but could you give us the WHO definition of a pandemic level six?
Sure. WHO, as I said earlier, has six regions, and for it to be considered a level six pandemic or pandemic, you have to have sustained community transmission occurring in at least two of those six regions.
And it, doesn't it also have to be a novel virus as opposed to something of an animal base?
Well, I think, put it this way, that normally only a novel virus would cause such widespread transmission so fast. It doesn't, I mean, the phases there, I think what's most important is the fact is that we're seeing, the reason we're seeing such wide transmission is because it is a novel virus. But, the main thing is that the virus has spread and is entrenched in communities in at least two WHO regions.
Particular bother here in North America is it appears that some of the indigenous populations have really suffered badly with a more severe version of the disease or manifestation of this influenza virus. Are you seeing this and other parts of the world also? And what are your thoughts on the indigenous people's symptomology as, in such a quote-unquote mild outbreak of a novel virus?
Well, we've seen this in Mexico, and we're seeing it in Canada. I'm not sure what the case in the United States is, that people who have immunosuppressions or underlying health conditions of one sort or another are more likely to suffer severe illness. So if you look in populations that have chronic conditions such as obesity or asthma or chronic heart conditions or where there's a lot of immunosuppression due to tuberculosis prevalence or HIV prevalence or other conditions, and a special case then also is pregnant women. But for communities where I mentioned the other conditions where prevalence is much higher than normal, we are indeed seeing a higher rates of more severe illness, and this is something which is going to have to be very closely watched, and we are vigilant for as the virus spreads around the world.
Does WHO have any teams in the Canada region or in North America looking at this now?
Well, we are in constant contact with the public health agencies of Canada and the United States, and really, I mean, Canada and the United States have fantastic capacity of their own, and there's nothing that we could do that the Canadian and American public health authorities couldn't do on their own.
Right. I was just thinking for extrapolation to a world situation as this thing is spreading, and now it's going into India, and it's going into other places of high density. Then you begin to worry about why are some populations looking like they have a more severe version.
Sure. I mean, we do have very, very frequent teleconferences and occasional face-to-face meetings with the public health authorities in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, because those three countries have by far the most experience with the virus so far. And listening to and learning from what they have learned in turn allows us to help other countries be better prepared.
Let me ask you a question. When a country calls WHO, and I think Egypt did this a month ago, when they seemed to have sort of a grouping of young children catching bird flu, small children. And they call WHO and they say, listen, we have a problem. Can you come down here? What is the procedure for that? What does WHO do? How long does it take you to get to a country when they ask for help? And when you get on the ground, you know, what do you do? People will wonder, what does WHO do?
Okay. So there's no exact blueprint. It's not ever exactly the same because, but in any case, yes, we come in at the invitation of the National Health Authority, and they tell us what their concerns are, what they would like us to look at, and then we then put together a team which can consist both of internal WHO people and external collaborators, consultants or people who join us from other institutions such as the US CDC or the Canadian Public Health Authority or other European organizations or wherever they come from. In any case, and we put together a team with the competencies that we need in order to address the problem. And so, you know, it's always a multidisciplinary team to some extent, but the disciplines will vary according to the needs. And we'll go down there, and we get a good briefing from the Ministry of Health, and then we'll do the investigative work and submit our conclusions to the government.
And usually in those cases, you like to try to use the WHO-approved, what might be the nearest WHO-approved lab, so that you have sort of your standard or your protocols in order are being performed, no?
Well, one thing we're doing in parallel or at the same time as all the other work is going on is working with many countries around the world to increase laboratory diagnostic abilities. And I mean, in the specific case of H1N1, what we've been able to do is to distribute PCR-based diagnostic kits to many, many countries in the world so that they can test in country already to preliminarily to see if they've got positive cases of the virus or not. And then also help national laboratories increase their capacity to identify a range of other pathogens as time goes on. I mean, a big example is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which frequently has suspect Ebola cases. Up to a couple of years ago, DRC wasn't able to diagnose its own cases and had to send samples elsewhere, but now the National Laboratory is able to do that on its own. So that's what we'd like to see many, if not all, countries be able to do.
That's perfect. Great explanation there. So how many WHO, quote-unquote, WHO diagnostic labs are there? There's, what, seven or in the world, how many?
No, it depends on the disease.
Okay.
So we have hundreds of what we call collaborating centers, but that it very much it varies disease by disease. So in terms of influenza, we have five, and they're in Memphis, Tennessee, Atlanta, Georgia, London, in the UK, Tokyo, Japan, and Australia, and I believe it's Melbourne in Australia. So that's where the what they're called the five reference laboratories are.
And then how about for avian influenza?
They'd be the same laboratories.
Same
five laboratories in the world which really are our reference centers for H5N1.
Okay, for H5N1 and it's influenza.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I just feel like we're following so many different things here. I don't know how you all keep it straight, but all the different diseases, and then you have priority diseases, quote-unquote, which I don't think are exactly a priority, but, you know, you're also following HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, in addition to these other diseases, you know, the pandemic disease situation also. So
yeah.
It's, I don't know how you all keep it straight, but I guess that's why you all get paid the big money, huh? I'd like to talk about vaccines also with you. Where are we? If you could give us a little synopsis on what you know about where we are with the H1N1 vaccine development, and then you know how that might apply to H5N1 and where we are with these.
Well, the two vaccines don't have anything to do with one another, so to speak, because obviously at the moment influenza vaccine technology is strain-specific. There is no such thing as a general influenza vaccine, although there is scientific or experimental work going on in that area. So the seed strains for an H1N1 vaccine have been developed and have been distributed free of charge to any vaccine manufacturer who requests it, and that's been done. And we are now also in the process vaccine manufacturers are in the process of developing the vaccine. And from start to finish, from identification of the seed strain to the time that the vaccine actually becomes available for administration, it's between 4 and 6 months, we always say. So we're in the middle, we're in that 4 to 6 month period, and it just has to continue running.
Sure. So basically, this year, the seasonal flu vaccine is finishing its run, just about, isn't it?
Yeah.
By
July, at some point, almost all seasonal vaccine will have been produced that was planned to be produced.
So the capacity is freed up for an H1N1 run, but even then, there won't be any chance for any kind of general distribution of that this calendar year. Functionally, for most people, they won't have the opportunity to get that.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's going to be decisions along the way of when this vaccine run is done, as you say, the seasonal vaccine run in July. How much vaccine production capacity will be used for H1N1 and how much will be used for so-called seasonal influenza? Because that decision hasn't been taken yet either. And then in terms of how much vaccine is going to be available when, the worldwide maximum vaccine production capacity is 94 million courses or doses per week. And, when that comes online and how that gets distributed, those are questions which I don't think anyone has answers to yet.
Right. I guess I'm responding to some of the media reports that come out, and I don't understand how these happen, but they'll listen to the same CDC briefing I hear or the same WHO briefing that I hear, and I hear that exactly what you just said. A lot of this is up in the air. Some testing still has to be done. Production decisions aren't totally made yet. But sometimes a media report will come out and say, oh, you know, vaccine will be done by October or something of this nature, which gives the average person who's picking up the newspaper or logging onto the Internet the idea that the average man on the street, in October or November, will be able to go to his doctor or his public health clinic and say, I would like to have the H1N1 vaccine. And I think that is not true. I think people need to understand that the chances of them actually being able to acquire for themselves personally, an average person, a vaccine for H1N1, probably most of this calendar year, is probably slim to none.
Yeah, as I said, vaccine production is 94 million doses per week, and maximum worldwide. And so you have to take into account when that 94 billion production starts, when it gets up to full steam, if it gets up to full steam, and where that vaccine will go. So as you say, the message that people should be getting should be much more nuanced.
Yes, that's what I think too. So great, so we agree on that. it's amazing when I hear the same news conferences that they hear, and I come away with exactly what you just said, but then I see what gets into print, and I'm thinking, how did they hear that from what I heard, too? And I don't know, sometimes maybe it's a way to sell papers or something. I'm not sure what that's about. Great, so let's go on to H5N1. This is, I have to just tell you, I'm a little bit disturbed. Because it's, of course, we've lost, I think, a lot of our ability to track it. because, of course, a lot of people are concerned about H1N1, and it's got a level 6 declaration. And of H5N1, luckily, is still at only a level 3. But, you know, this is the one that has a terrifically high case fatality rate. Could you explain what the level 3 is for everybody?
Yeah. Level 3 means that the disease, influenza, is overwhelmingly still an animal disease, and that it only occasionally causes disease in humans. And when it does cause disease in humans, it doesn't normally or if ever cause sustained chains of transmission in humans.
Okay, and so areas of that have historically seen some problems have been China, of course, from numerous years ago, particularly, and in a few recent cases. Indonesia has historically had the leading number of human cases. Egypt has had quite a year this year, with quite a few cases more than last year, primarily in young children, and primarily mild cases in those children. So there's a whole range of issues here. One is, I guess I'll start with Indonesia. It just seems like they have, the WHO chart shows zero cases in Indonesia this year. Should we be concerned with that number?
As you say, I think the focus of H5N1 is probably elsewhere at the moment. Certainly, I think Egypt has seen more activity than anywhere else. The government of Indonesia reports its cases, but only periodically. We do feel we have a handle on what's going on in Indonesia. And as I say, I think, you know, other areas there appears to be more activity in other areas.
So where do you feel the problem areas are in H1N1 now? Or H5N1, sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, a problem area, I wouldn't want to say a problem area, but I would just say, let's say the most activity that we've seen at the moment or this year has been in Egypt, apparently. Certainly that's what's grabbed the news headlines rather than anything happening in any other country H5N1-wise.
What is your take on the fact that these, by far the majority of the cases this year in Egypt, and I believe it's something like 26, I don't have the chart in front of me, are mild, and it's of course in children, which makes sense because they're at ground level with the poultry and have more access to those contagions. But it seems like what is your understanding that these cases seem to be so mild that all of these children, virtually almost all of them, are recovering?
Yeah, but again, if I remember correctly, the first death ever in a child in Egypt was this year. So it's not completely easy to say exactly why what is happening in Egypt is happening. There could be a number of factors. And the team, you mentioned earlier a team that we had sent down to Egypt. And when that team went down there, it helped the government of Egypt look into what was happening H5N1-wise there, and basically came to the conclusion that really the virus hadn't changed. And I think if you look at this, what happens in Egypt is that there appears to be a culture in Egypt where children are taken to the hospital even as soon as they sneeze, if you like. So they normally are put on oseltamivir very soon after the course of the disease starts. And, you know, the sooner the person gets put on oseltamivir, the better, apparently from what we can tell, the better the chances are of survival. That's not been 100% correlation, but certainly it appears to be the case that oseltamivir needs to be administered, let's say, within 48 to 72 hours after the onset of symptoms, and the sooner you can, the better it stops viral replication, which is very important in H5N1. So it could be that actually is the reason why children have such good survival rates in Egypt.
Right. That's a great you know, one of the great reasons. What about the fact that it appears that none of the parents have been diagnosed with bird flu? Are they also, when the child shows up and it looks like the child may have it, are they starting the whole giving it prophylactically to the family, the parents?
I can't answer. I don't know if they're giving it prophylactically. I think they are, because normally they do give it prophylactically to anyone who's had close contact with a confirmed case. But I wouldn't be 100%. I can't swear on the Bible that that's the case. But in any case, what also happens is we know that H5N1 doesn't transmit very well. It's very difficult actually to contract it from another human being. And so again, what you said a little earlier is probably what happens. Probably is that children who tend to play much more interactively with chickens almost as toys, especially in poorer neighborhoods in Egypt, and where there's a lot of dust and where there's a lot of things in general being thrown up into the air, have a much better chance of inhaling this virus than do adults who only come into contact with chickens, let's say, when it's time to slaughter the chicken. And a child often will play with a sick or a dead chicken any time, you know, before an adult would have contact with it. And so by that time, the danger that the child is the one who's been exposed to it rather than the adult. So it could be that that's actually the explanation why why children and not their parents get the disease.
Yes, there's just a little bit of an anomaly there, and you're always trying to find out or think to yourself why why is this happening when the overall rate, like you said, is somewhere around 60% worldwide to date. So let me ask.
But
you
Egypt,
this.
Egypt's always had a lower fatality rate than other countries.
Right. I think they had, in northern Egypt, they had a fairly high, really high case fatality rate previously. And in southern Egypt, it seemed whatever that strain was, it seemed to be fairly low case fatality rate. So now, I'm not sure genetically how all of these strains mix and match and pick up things and drop other things is really a mystery to me. I think Dr. Osterholm said it really well. He said the more he's learned about influenza, the less he knows. And I think this is true. I think the more we find out, the more we realize we just really don't even know. It's a big mystery, huh?
Yeah, we do know that there are genetic differences between H5N1 strains in various places around the world. But people don't have a really good understanding yet of what the consequences of the strains being different are.
Several companies have reported that they've been working on an H5N1 vaccine, some of them using a new cellular technology. I don't know what the latest is on that in light of this H1N1 event. Do you have any idea of what they're doing at this point?
No, I really don't. Sorry. As you say, there are probably about 10 companies who have been trying to develop an H5N1 vaccine and have got it to various stages of testing and approval. But of course, you know, it's never been tested on humans in clinical trials, as far as I know, except for very, very small batches of people. And the clinical efficacy has all been the result of, or the efficacy that has been claimed for the different virus or the different vaccines is because of in vitro studies in the lab. And with only less than 500 people still having been infected with H5N1 since the virus first was recorded or noted in humans, it's difficult to do any kind of meaningful trials in humans.
The world's population is something like, 6.3 billion?
Yeah, something like that.
And so even with, get an H1N1 vaccine or H5N1 vaccine or something developed, and it seems to be working well, and the adjuvant's good, and we get the trials, and you know, let's say, you know, by the end of this year, there's been some trials and there's been some production start, and, you know, maybe by the beginning of next year, 2010, you know, really we could start actually looking at a production and some distribution, fairly wide distribution, if we can get 90 plus million a week out. But still, if you look at the gross number of people in the world of 6.3 billion, most people in a pandemic wave of, 8 weeks or 10 weeks or something, you know, will not see a vaccine for quite a while. And so what is WHO suggesting that the majority of the world's population do, who probably will never see a vaccine of any kind in a pandemic situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we just have to help people understand that there are measures which can be taken before a vaccine becomes available, and those include, you know, self-protective measures, social distancing measures, et cetera. And there are antivirals available for those people who do get infected. Again, antiviral stocks aren't unlimited, but antiviral stocks do exist.
There's been some talk of alternative, treatments. One would be antibodies, but that's a fairly specialized treatment. I don't know how that would be applied in mass. And then there was another, Dr. Fetson has been promoting an idea of doing some randomized trials with some of the generic drugs that are already commonly available and are mass-produced in various countries, including India. Does the WHO have any thoughts on the antibody treatment or genetic drugs for pandemic use?
I wouldn't say. I think everything is worth studying and exploring if the treatment can be effective in one sense or another, but it's certain that some treatments need a lot of work still and would take a lot longer to prove their efficacy if the efficacy were ever proved. But, I mean, I don't think WHO would ever want to dismiss anything completely out of hand and instantaneously on it, because we do know that there are certain alternative medicines which do function quite well. But on the other hand, we would want to know, in the same way as for any other medicine, that the efficacy and the safety of this medicine was actually what it is purported to be.
Right, right. Of course, it all goes back to funding trials and funding studies to get some of these things done. But it's really concerning when you look at the number of people that actually live on the planet, and then you look at the production of vaccine or antivirals, and then you have to look at it and say, the number, the math doesn't add up here. For me, anyway, I just take the 6.3 billion and I divide by almost any number, and then you realize the number of months that actually lapses into years before everybody would be able to take advantage of some of the technologies that are available in the world now. It's great that we have them, but it makes sense to sort of look at some of the things that are available now. And one thing that we always push, of course, on flu trackers is the stuff that I guess we had in the last pandemic. Wash your hands, personal sanitation, social distancing, even making a mask out of anything, just any sort of a barrier that you can get, even if it's not an N95 or a surgical mask, certainly social distancing coupled with something that will stop influenza particles from coming into your face, even a torn T-shirt or something, is more effective than maybe nothing.
Well, I don't know if we would fully agree with that.
Okay. We don't know either. So it's just a matter of, I guess, a dialogue of trying to decide, what works best. And
I think masks are problematic. Masks tend to be, on the one hand, they sometimes give people a false sense of security. And two, masks, if not used correctly, can actually lead to more illness rather than less, because what will happen a lot of times with masks is that people, you know, continue to touch and to touch surfaces where, or things or other people, or touch whatever infected places with their hands and get the virus on their hands. And then at the same time, because masks are uncomfortable, they will constantly fidget and play with the masks. And actually, that then becomes a bigger risk than no mask at all, because if you put your infected hand constantly on your face in the region of your nose and mouth, there's a very good chance, or a much greater chance than otherwise, that you would inhale and respire the virus. So actually, what WHO would say is that in normal circumstances, a mask actually should probably only be used by people who are already sick, because a mask is effective in stopping virus from being exhaled and aspirated into the environment. So it's much more efficient for people who are already sick to wear masks, and then for other people, to go back to your basically hand-washing measures and social distancing measures, are probably what we would believe would be most effective.
Okay, well, that's great. On that note, of course, again, you all follow every disease that there is in the world and keep track of what's going on. And one disease that is upsetting, of course, along with others, is MRSA, which is the drug-resistant strain that's out there. And particularly this one teenager that died in the United States recently, they're now saying that he actually also had MRSA. And so that when he did get swine flu, the fact that he had a MRSA infection is what caused his rapid decline. So how important is it in the world now for us to be looking at some of these emerging diseases and some of these drug-resistant diseases in terms of, complicating the other existing diseases that are out there?
Well, it's always important. And as you say, unfortunately, there are so many dynamics and dimensions of trying to create a good health system that sometimes you can't concentrate on all these dynamics or dimensions at the same time, and much as we would like to. And nonetheless, it's very true that whenever it appears to be the case that when H1N1 is involved, if someone has another infection or a condition which compromises their immune systems, they're at greater risk of severe disease.
Correct. And so the diseases that the WHO has listed on the site, on your site, as the priority diseases, and I think there's no such thing as really a priority disease, really, but you have main focuses on HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Do you want to just give us a quick little synopsis of what WHO is doing in those three areas?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I don't work with those diseases much, so I'm not the best person to ask on that. But certainly, in terms of burden of disease, HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria are huge burdens in terms of mortality, morbidity, and effects on the health system in many developing countries, and in some cases also in developed countries. So that's obviously why we pay so much attention to those three diseases, although, of course, we do to other diseases also and conditions.
Right. I think there's something like 246 million cases of malaria in 2006, mostly in Africa, which is a terrifically high number of infection. And if you look at tuberculosis, it's also very pervasive all over the place, and particularly also Africa, too. So if this gives more concern, if it's a pandemic, or not if, but you know, there is a pandemic now, H5N1, it gets in Africa, where you have some of these entrenched diseases. It makes it even harder to treat or prevent or, I don't know, mitigate pandemic influenza of any kind, whether it's H1N1, bird flu, or some sort of combination, or seasonal flu even, regular seasonal flu. Does the WHO have teams in Africa that are watching for these kinds of things?
Yes. I mean, but first of all, let's go back. I mean, we don't know if the effects of H5N1 and H1N1 in immune compromised populations will be the same. It could well be, but then again, maybe it won't be. We have only seen really, we've already got much more experience of H1N1 than we do of H5N1 in this short time because, you know, we have over 50,000 cases of H1N1 where we have less than 500 cases of H5N1. So the focus really at the moment is in kind of places like Africa, Eastern Mediterranean, Asia, helping our member states detect and treat H1N1, and certainly H1N1 will probably be expected to have greater manifestations of more severe illness in immunocompromised populations and in probably also malnourished populations. So it could well be that we'll see more severe manifestations of this disease in time in Africa, for example.
Well, it looks like we're getting a little bit low on time. I just wanted to ask you, just since we're on the Internet, we're in Internet media, there's always these, you know, WHO rumors on the Internet, and I'm sure you all hear them. Is there anything you would like to bring up or address or talk about that, you know, this is your chance, because we're pretty well read on the Internet. Is there anything you all want to bring up or talk about?
Just thank you for this time that you've given us, and you know, WHO is here to look after the interests of member states that can't look after themselves so well. So as we're going forward, we'll be continuing to try to ensure that the levels of health care and health and readiness and prevention for member states that are less fortunate than, say, those in North America are most able to help themselves, and that's really what we're about. And thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. And, you know, we did make the request that if there's any cutting to be done for time, that your remarks are stay intact 100%. I'm saying this now because the editor, you know, when they go to cut this, will cut the right thing, which is
okay.
cut my remarks, not Mr. Hartle's remarks, if we have a time constraint. There are a couple of Internet rumors. You can just respond to these. I'm just throwing them out there. One is that, you know, who keeps big secrets? Is this true? Does WHO keep big secrets? Or, you know, I mean, I know you all operate at the behest of the member states, so does this hamper your ability to communicate, or give a response to that?
No. I mean, I know that sometimes I've on certain blogs, WHO or the UN system is seen as having, you know, big black helicopters or whatever that fly around the place doing all sorts of secret things, but, I mean, we strive to be as transparent as possible, because the more information that we can get out, the better prepared and able people will be, both on an individual level and on a governmental level, to take actions to protect themselves and their countries when the virus starts being present in large volumes, let's say, or large numbers of transmissions in their country.
And another one is that WHO has these, I guess, I don't know, big, storage places where there's all sorts of sequences that are being hidden. you all hide sequences or genetic material from the world?
No. No, and as a matter of fact, we're working on we encourage publication of genetic sequences on whatever database is possible, because the more that this is publicized, the more people can work on it, and the better chance we have of finding, as a result of the gene sequence information being out there, an effective means of producing a vaccine or some sort of medicine to counteract the pathogen in question. You know, we would have no interest and no justification in trying to hide something. Our interest is in public health, and public health is best served by transparency.
Well, that's great. I just thought I'd bring it up because, you know, this stuff floats around, and if it's anything like some of the mainstream media reports that I saw regarding the swine flu that, you know, a month ago, and the internet rumors at the same time, it's just better to get it out there and to ask you, and then you know, we can just go on to something else. And again, thank you so much for your time, and you've been really great, and I just, you know, asked you out of the blue, and you said sure, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay.